today, 1.8 trillion reasons why home prices haven't fallen yet. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, Working Letters Post, covering finance and broader news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
Hey, Martin, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. So the great extend and pretend continues.
I think we've actually passed the point of extend and pretend. Now, I think we're now in the land of fake it till you make it.
We could almost use that title, couldn't we? It is remarkable. I mean, if you start itemizing all of the things which are being done to protect property prices, look from the Reserve Bank, look at the government, look at the states, everybody is all throwing the same sort of stuff to try and stop the inevitable happening.
Well, it's the kitchen sink approach, isn't it? I mean, I think one of the ones that really got me was Victoria. You know, the fact that they're offering a 50% land tax holiday on some build to rent properties until 2040. You know, the fact that they're committing to that revenue hit for the next 20 years on property is just a bit nuts to me, to be completely honest with you. Yep. You know, I mean, Victoria is a state that's just deep in the red. They're in big, big trouble, you know, big problems with the economy and with the labor market. And yet they've still got money to throw billions away on propping up property prices.
Yes. Well, you know, you could look at that. You can look at Western Australia, who's got all those, you know, homeland package things going on. You can look at New South Wales and, of course, their strategy to take away stamp duty and get people to pay recurring annual land taxes instead. That's really very popular, I'm sure. But stand back and think more broadly. You know, you've got the mortgage repayment holidays, which are still running at the moment and, you know, meant to be finishing in March. My guess is they'll probably be extended. You've got the very, very low, cheap funding through the TFF from the Reserve Bank, which means that banks in Australia now can borrow at ridiculously low levels, frankly, cheap, zero, close to zero. And that means that they can offer lower and lower rates on mortgages. So many people potentially can get cheap mortgages. You know, wherever you look, you can see all the fingers in the dike trying to keep the inevitable from happening. And, you know, I have to tell you that my modelling is now starting to suggest that the probability of prices going sideways or slightly higher over the next 2 or 3 years is definitely higher than it was. But I still come back to the point, we are taking stimulus away and there's more stimulus being taken away the next quarter and the next quarter, right? And we've still got a lot of people who are financially very cash-strapped even now. So there are these sort of two sets of tensions all pulling in different directions. But everybody, you know, should understand, taxpayers are supporting the housing sector.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in your discussion with the guys from Nucleus Wealth recently, Damian Klassen made an excellent point, and he said that one of the key factors that we should keep an eye on going forward is what happens with the RBA's term funding facility, or the TFF for short, because if the RBA keeps throwing money at the banks and they keep throwing this cheap funding, maybe it's possible we do see rates go lower. You know, if we do see further actions further down the yield curve by the RBA with QE, we could see rates go lower. We could see longer fixed rate mortgages. All those things are on the table if they choose to pursue them and if they choose to dedicate the resources to it. So I think I think Damian made a very, very excellent point there that we really need to keep in mind going forward. I mean, I'm pretty sure he suggested that you should put that in your scenarios. You know, how much is the RBA going to throw at the TFF?
So, well, it is a critical issue, right? Because there's two factors. The first factor, of course, is that the banks are able to swap out expensive funding for cheaper funding through the TFF, right? Their margins give more capacity then to transfer that into much lower mortgage rates. Now, what they're doing, of course, is not transferring that to existing mortgage holders. What they're doing is hanging the hook out there to get new business. So it's quite interesting just watching that. And they're quite selective, actually, in terms of who they're actually allowing these very cheap rates to come to. But it's not clear to me that we've reached the lowest level. I think we'll probably see rates go even lower from this point. But remember this, we've got the highest debt to GDP, or second highest, very high debt to income ratio. We've got a lot of debt in the system already. And, debt has two components. The first component is serviceability. So sure, serviceability is improving. The other one is repayment. I can't see how a limit of these households are going to pay back what they owe.
Well, I suppose it just depends on how the RBA and the government choose, well, and APRA as well, choose to go about things. Because, in the US at first, they ran things business as usual. People lost their homes, people got foreclosed on, the banks came in, they sold off the assets, and that obviously helped further. It didn't create the drop in prices in the US, but it did sort of, amplify that particular effect that was already going on as a result of the recession. So, but that then begs the question, are they going to follow the approach of the US at first, or are they going to choose the approach of the US that they took in sort of 2011, or more like 2012, 2013, yep, where all these people had defaulted on their loans, weren't making payments. Some of them haven't made payments for, 3, 4, 5 years at this point. And they just didn't do anything. They just let them stay in their homes. They just, wore the losses. The government's, supplied funding to the banks and sort of, as a de facto bailout, here you go. You guys just let these people stay in their homes and no forced sales. And I mean, to be honest, from what I've read, some of these people are still in their homes in negative equity today, 12 years later. So, I mean, I just wonder, are they going to do the same thing here? I mean, we're talking kitchen sink here, so nothing's really off the table.
Well, you're right. In the US, there are still people who have not made any mortgage repayments for a large number of years and are still in their properties, and nobody's really worrying about it, right? Which is weird, but true. So basically, the standard approach to you borrow and then repay has, for those people, disappeared completely. And you're right. If you stand back and think about how all this is working, it's more and more likely that we're going to see more and more support for various elements. Anything to stop this whole thing falling over, right? Now, the question is, what is the economic and social costs of doing that, right? And I think the economic costs are worth thinking about for a minute. 1.8 trillion, wasn't just a number plucked out of the air. That is what the budget papers suggested could be the total debt pool in, a few years' time, if all this thing plays out the way that they were thinking, right? And by the way, their budget was relatively optimistic in terms of the bounce back relative to what I think we may see. So there's a big chunk of debt. Now, of course, the argument is, well, debt is very cheap because rates are so low, because the RBA is pushing the yield curve down, so governments are paying less than they were. And in fact, the UK this last week came up with a whole bunch of additional spending to try and support the economy. I mean, their GDP is going to, definitely take another big hit. But their total debt repayment is lower than it was a year or two ago, right? So that's, how weird is that? So that's sort of one of the factors there. But the other factor is that as this sort of burden of debt from a repayment perspective may be manageable, the capital amount is still there. It's still sitting. Now, is that a problem? Well, in traditional thinking, it is. But maybe we're in a whole new world where debt doesn't matter anymore.
Well, the question is, I mean, we are in a world where debt doesn't matter anymore, at least for the moment. You look at, the other day, Greek 3-year bond yields went negative.
Yep.
I don't think that the possibility of Greece defaulting in the next 3 years is below zero. So, that we've completely stopped pricing risk appropriately. So, I mean, it just depends on how long this particular sort of, It's like what they said, in 1929. It's like, this is a permanently high plateau. Except in this instance, is how long is this new debt paradigm going to last? Is it going to last a month, a year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? I mean, a lot of people after the GFC said, okay, this can't keep going on forever and ever. And, here we are 12 years later, more and more debt. And, and basically it's got to the point now where, basically anything and everything that is significantly large enough is a systemic risk. because there is so much debt, and it's so simple for any one thing around the world, if not properly managed, to create an enormous crisis. You know, whether it's, say, for example, like in China at the moment, the bond yields for state-owned enterprises on new issuances have risen by over 100 basis points, which is a big, big move for something that is ostensibly backed by Beijing. So there's all these different things that could go, you know, sort of cataclysmically wrong and create, you know, the conditions for another, you know, financial crisis and something that makes March look like not such a big deal. But the question is it going to be allowed to play out, or are they just going to stomp on it? Is the central banks and the government's just going to stomp on it the moment something goes wrong? You know, I mean, like you said, like you've been saying, you know, we just don't really have capitalism anymore.
No, well, that's right. So essentially, we're in this one-way street to nowhere, where the debt just continues to expand and expand. The serviceability is not too bad at the moment, although, of course, if rates do start to rise down the track, that could be an issue. But of course, individual households are still sitting on massive amounts of debt even now, and you know, the question is, are they able and willing to just spend less and less on other things and more on, you know, bigger debts, right? Because essentially that's the theory. And remember this, you know, as I often remind people, financial services companies look at individuals in terms of their future cash flow. So can they go on sustaining debt repayments into the future? If they can, then they discount that, you know, whatever interest rate, and that's the value of that individual person, right? So effectively, the individuals and households and businesses are effectively cash flow fodder to the banks, and that's all they care about.
Yeah, and just to go back on the issue of like the governments and the central banks supporting the system, we're starting to see signs that they're not willing to keep the money taps open forever and ever. Maybe in central bank land, yes, they are, but even the Fed is talking about tapering. Mm. I mean, yes, they're talking about tapering and going further down the yield curve, because I mean, I suppose you could make the argument that there's not really that much more they can do at the short end of the curve. But it's also the same in terms of fiscal policy. Like, you're starting to see a lot of the states and territories here in Australia and the federal government starting to claw back money. You know, say in Victoria, you know, they're increasing the number of speed cameras basically exponentially, so they can derive more revenue. Or federally, Scott Morrison's postponed the replacement of the Spirit of Tasmania ferries, so the government can save money. And there's all these little different things that are ultimately, you know, removing that extra cash from the economy. And it's removing, and not only that, but it's removing cash from the productive economy as well. Because if you're removing, you know, say something like a ship, you know, if we end up in a situation where one of them breaks down, that affects tourism to Tasmania. That affects, you know, tourism to Victoria. And, you know, you're removing the productive engine of the economy. And instead of doing that, you're just going, oh, bugger it, we'll give it to the banks, or we'll give it to people to keep paying their mortgages.
Yeah, and that is the point, right? There are decisions being taken to support X rather than Y, to prioritize over here rather than over there. And every time those decisions are being taken, there is a political agenda that's actually driving it.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's the same thing in the UK. At the moment, UK Labour are going after Boris Johnson, something rotten, saying you're wasting all our money. You know, you know, even though the vast majority of it is being spent on support for households and businesses, it's like you're wasting money. It's once again become a political issue, as it probably should have been in the first place, because, you know, the panic and the emergency of the pandemic has really sort of passed from a psychological perspective for government. And that's really the problem now across the world. You know, in America, you know, there's no longer the urgency to pass any stimulus. You know, they're talking about probably a third of what they were talking about if Biden's blue wave ended up getting up. You know, and even here in Australia, you know, if we get to a point in March where things look pretty good, aside from the fact that we've still got millions on JobKeeper, continuing that policy is going to be politically a lot more difficult than if things looked a lot worse.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, you rather feel we're in that sort of shades of grey sort of environment where, you know, this could go on for a long, long time. Maybe the immediate crisis has passed, although, you know, then we'll see that come back. And, it, you know, in that context, if you're a first-time buyer, right, And you're sort of watching all of this and you're thinking, well, you know, maybe I should just begin to think about engaging with the market rather than just sitting back and, you know, waiting for things to sort of, get clearer. There's a real dilemma. I'm seeing it in a lot of my surveys and amongst first-time buyers. There's a real question mark beginning to form in many people's minds.
No, definitely. I mean, even for myself as someone who doesn't own a house, you've got to look at it and you've got to think, geez, you know, they're going to manage to engineer some wacky price growth out of nowhere despite the pandemic. I mean, and to be completely honest with you, it wouldn't be unprecedented. You know, it would be unprecedented before this year. But, you know, you look at New Zealand, they've had 20% price growth in the last 8 months. You know, this, you know, similar numbers in parts of the US. So that fear and anxiety amongst first home buyers is definitely, I think, justified. And aside from the fact that I find it just painfully wrong and frankly, morally reprehensible, you know, that's where we're at. And, you know, the government's throwing the kitchen sink, you know, they're going to get, if the crossbench votes the way they say they're going to vote, we're going to have super withdrawals to fund deposits for homes, which could frankly put a rocket under prices in certain places. You know, it's less likely to have an impact in, you know, sort of the median Melbourne or Sydney homes so much because they're already so expensive. But in places like Brisbane or Perth or Adelaide, where things are a bit cheaper, an extra 60, you know, an extra say 20, 40, $60,000 on a deposit makes a whole lot difference to what someone can borrow, what they can afford. And it's quite concerning. And I think what people need to do is just really just get down to the nitty gritty for what they in the area they want, you know, get their hands on something like your data that for the potential upsides, the potential downsides, and then really just go from there.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's two questions. The first question is, are prices going to plummet, you know, 20, 30, 40%. Remember, they're overvalued, you know, on an absolute basis by 20, 30, 40%, right? So we're in that sort of high plateau area, to borrow your earlier phrase. But that doesn't necessarily mean that prices are going to plummet, right? In the short term, at least, maybe, you know, later. But so that's the first. And then the second question is, well, do they just go then sideways, you know, slightly down, slightly up, or do they accelerate away again? Now, my own perspective is still, I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see anything like the massive hikes in prices that we saw over the previous 30 years, because we've already had the rates dropping from, you know, 17 down to sort of close to zero now. We already got the very, very generous lending standards. So that there's a limit to how much of that can be played again. And after the global financial crisis, rates were cut 5%. Well, we can't cut 5%. But nevertheless, we've got very low interest rates and we've got all this government stimulus and all these incentives. So that's the sort of the trade-off. Now, my own modelling is still saying there's hardly significant upside ahead. Might be in some locations a little bit upside, but it's more sort of sideways or slightly down from this point. And then the question is, if you're a first-time buyer, well, is that okay? Can you engage with that? And can you find something that makes sense? I guess if you're thinking of a place to live in, that's a different from property investment. I don't see many property investors yet saying, oh, we must get back in the market quick. Are there people more selling than buying, property investors? But own occupiers, you know, there's a bit of an argument for saying, do the work, find out, you know, whether there are locations that make sense, and to get granular. And in fact, this past week, I've run a couple of shows where on Tuesday, I had a couple of people there who are very familiar with this whole debate, and we went through all the issues. So go watch that show with Veronica and Megan if you want to look at that. And previously, I spoke to Steve from Canstar, who also put some very important messages in there about, for first-time buyers, this is not a simple time to make decisions. You know, there are very lots of great complexities. But nevertheless, I don't think you can necessarily assume that we're going to see significant price falls in the short term, medium term, longer term, who knows? So many vagaries, so many uncertainties. But 1.8 trillion is a big number.
Indeed. I think that your conversation with Steve from Canstar really was just emblematic of where we're at. It is a very, very challenging time for people. There are so many different moving parts and variables, and frankly, even the experts don't have any idea. All these economic forecasts have basically got to the point where a chimpanzee with a with a reasonable range of outcomes and a dart could pretty much get closer than most people. That's just the way it is. You know, it's a very tough environment. It's an unprecedented environment for. I mean, they didn't have a PMI back in during the Spanish flu, or they didn't calculate things in the same way that we do today. So we don't really have any precedent for how to sort of adjust for all that, the changes in consumer psychology, etc. But at the end of the day, I think what's important is that, like you said, this could push price falls out further. You know, maybe we could even see a couple of years of growth in some places before we see price falls. Because at the end of the thing is, I think that, say, Dr. Cameron Murray, I think he's right in the sense that we haven't seen the impact of rate cuts yet. Because when rates get cut, prices rise. We haven't seen that entirely feed through just yet. Now, personally, I was of the opinion that basically that was going to be countered by the economic strife. Now, that's still roughly my view, because we just have to see how things play out at the start of next year. You know, what actually happens with JobKeeper, what actually happens with the economy, because everything until then is all just guesswork. It's all just maybes and that sort of things. But beyond that, I think that, you know, you might see this final blow off in places that haven't already, that haven't seen strong price growth. Like I said, in the smaller capitals, places like that, where it's a lot, not just cheaper to buy than rent, but like less than half the price, you're actually gaining equity in the property in places like that. And I think that's why, like you say, it's so important to get granular, to look at exactly what you want, where you want it, and go, okay, I found this property. I'm looking at buying. It's going to be $150 or $200 a week cheaper than renting in terms of the interest costs, or maybe more. It just depends, what part of the market you're looking at. And then you've got to ask yourself, okay, well, if prices do fall X amount, how much equity am I going to have in 3 years' time or 4 years' time? Am I still going to end up in front? And if you are, then maybe that's a decision that's worth making. Maybe that, and if you're buying not for it as an investment, but as somewhere that you want to live, then that maybe that's something that's worth sitting down with your partner or with your financial advisor and, nutting out.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I always talk about the counterfactuals. What happens if you're wrong? How bad could it be? So that's worth thinking about. So, the expectation is unemployment's going to rise from this point before it falls away again. And, there's still the RBA is still saying unemployment will be higher in 2 years' time than it was before we started. So that's the first point. The second is we know there's no income growth. Income is going to be very, very constrained for those people in work at the moment, and probably for the next 1 to 2 years. In the UK, they've just announced a public sector pay freeze, for example. Well, whether we'll see the same here, who knows? But the chances are not much income growth. That's very important to understand, because in the early 2000s, it was income growth that got people out of jail when things played through. And the third one is then just to say, what are the limits to which the government may or may not go? That state and Fed together are just doing everything they can, and they'll probably do more. So that there's always sort of some questions there. But, what happens if there's a change in the leadership or a change in the party or after the next election, all those sorts of things? And then the final one, I think you've got to come back to this. We are still very reliant on China and the relationship with China and the trade with China. And there is lots of uncertainties there. And I keep looking at all this data thinking, we're still a one-trick pony.
Yeah, we are. And I think, like you say, with the fact that rates and all these other things have already fed through, because the thing is that, basically the government, to use an analogy, the government has a big pile of chips. When it started out back in the 90s, it had a big pile. It's thrown in the rate cuts, it's thrown in the grants, it's thrown in all these different things, it's thrown in the cuts to lending standards. But even if we do see price growth as a result of all this stuff, as a result of the super withdrawals, as a result of the cuts to lending standards and whatever other crazy crap they're going to cook up in the next, 6 to 12 months. That's it. You'll see prices adjust for the new paradigm, for the new conditions, and then that's it. Because every time the property market has started to look weak on a national level, on a large scale, every time the property market started to look weird over the last 20 years, the RBA has cut interest rates. which means next time we get into trouble, next time, you know, next time there's an economic downturn, they're going to have to, come up with something else entirely, because at that point they'll be out of conventional ammo. And that's why we're already seeing them, you know, dip into the super, cut the lending standards, because they don't really have any more ammo from a monetary perspective. So at that point, the government actually has to start spending their money rather than just saying, go spend your money.
Well, the point there is, it's our money that the government is spending, right? It's taxpayer money.
Oh, absolutely. But there's a political cost in spending taxpayer money.
Absolutely.
But if you just go to people, oh, go use your super, spend a couple, you know, 10 or 20 billion on housing deposits.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't cost them anything. And then, to be quite frank, I don't know if the polling is skewed or correct or not, but there seems to be quite a lot of public support for that option, which is frankly scary. But
well,
it is.
It's worth reflecting that, you know, of the 100 billion of stimulus or whatever it was that's been thrown into the economy, right? The largest single chunk was actually the superannuation withdrawals.
Yeah.
Right? and whose money's that? It's not the government's money.
Yeah, and just looking at that, you know, placing the focus on that for a moment, that was probably one of the most disturbing things I've watched.
Yep.
Because people happily went out and ripped tens of billions of dollars out of their super, and there was no financial advice. There was absolutely no proper consultation, which you need. Even if your financial advisor wants to swap your super over to a lower fee fund, they need to give you a big statement of advice. Usually it's dozens, if not hundreds of pages long, that you're supposed to read. Now this time there was none of that. It was just, oh, you want 20 grand? Yeah, sure, take it. Want to empty out your super? Yeah, sure. There's only 600,000 of you with absolutely nothing now. And I just find that so disturbing, to be completely honest with you, because it's not what super's for. You know, if it was for something else, it'd be different, but it's not the stated purpose.
Well, I think that's important. And it was interesting watching Keating in the week sort of trying to defend the superannuation system. I mean, my own perspective is the original idea might have been okay, but the execution and delivery of the superannuation system that we've got at the moment is pretty shameful, right? Because basically what it means is that those who are very affluent can put large amounts of tax-sheltered money away for the future. Right. Those who are actually further down the income scale have forced savings on them, right? And of course there's still a risk that they might put the forced savings up even higher. But the real point there is the industry is milking all of those people, because basically there are still fees and charges and other bits and pieces on the top. And if you look at the compounding effect of superannuation over time, what the fees are becomes a huge element. You know, if you're paying just a little bit more in terms of fees, your overall performance over the life of the fund drops dramatically. And yet there is really not enough transparency about that. Many of the fees are still not fully disclosed. Many people don't even know what fees they're actually paying. So my argument is that the superannuation system has been great for the financial services sector, great for financial advisors, but isn't necessarily performing anything like the way that it was originally conceived to be. And now, if you are actually saying, and by the way, superannuation is no longer about building a nest egg for future retirement, but it's also so that you can speculate on property on the way through if you want to, no problem at all. You know, and don't worry if you drop your balance in the process, it'll be fine. I mean, it's crazy. We've gone into a whole new ballgame.
And to be honest, what gets me about all of this is there's no nuance to the debate. Like, no, like I'm with you. The super system has some serious and profound issues. You know, like we spend so much on giving superannuation tax concessions to the wealthy that it's just ridiculous. We could literally, I mean, I've seen some modeling done, you know, I'm not sure who it was by, it might've been the Grattan Institute, but they've done modeling that basically says that we could have an extremely generous government pension for everyone if we just remove those tax concessions. If everyone just got a flat 15%, flat 15% discount on their concessional contributions, and it just boggles the mind, because it's so incredibly painfully broken. But if you attack it from either angle, you get smashed by either people who support the Liberal Party or people who support the Labor Party. And there's no nuance in terms of the actual required reforms to fix the super system, to save the budget and the taxpayer money, and also to get for people to get the best possible value for money and the best possible returns on their super. It's just stupid. But I mean, to be completely honest with you, it's just emblematic of where we're at as a, you know, politically speaking.
Well, sure, the whole thing is highly politicised, and people take, as you say, they take a political view based on which side of the aisle they're sitting, I guess, at the moment. And the other point to make is there that we're still quite early in the cycle in terms of the way that superannuation, you know, because it's been running for some number of years, we're now starting to see people move into retirement. And interestingly, the argument in that big review was that you got better performance out of the property market relative to investing in superannuation, which is crazy. Just play that by me again. So what they're saying is it's better to have your nest egg, your future wealth in property rather than actually in a superannuation scheme. I find that remarkable.
I think it's funny the way that the advocates of people who want to be able to access super for a home deposit, they say, yeah, well, it's okay, you don't need to worry about it, you're still going to have a big enough deposit anyway. A big enough retirement fund anyway. But by the same token, it's like Philip Lowe has said that we're going to have record low rates for the foreseeable future.
Yep.
Now that could change, but by the same token, if rates rise, it's basically going to blow up the financial system if they rise to a significant degree, which is why rates haven't risen to any real degree. You know, to any meaningful degree anyway, since the financial crisis, outside of places like Australia that were relatively successful, but that's all gone now. You know, you want to raise rates back to sort of, you know, 2012, 2014 levels, you'll take the property market and make it basically blow up within about 6 or 12 months. But how are people going to be able to get the returns on their super that they need to get their super balance back up to a reasonable level, which is going to be relatively high considering inflation and everything else in the next 30, 40 years? How are people going to be able to do that if rates are at record lows? It doesn't make any sense. Even if we just have, say, 5, 7, 10 years of low rates, you know, hypothetically speaking, that's going to kneecap the compounding effect on people's super, and they're going to end up with bugger all compared with people who had their super from like the 1980s, 1990s onwards, where you saw this enormous growth in stocks, this enormous growth in bonds. And this time there's nothing there. You know, there's nothing there in the 60-40 portfolio anymore. You know, bonds can't really go that much lower. So there's not really that sort of, you know, that sort of balanced return that there once was.
No. Well, that's of course why some people think, oh, of course, crypto is the answer, because, you know, the crypto went up to a very high number. It's come back now 11% in 2 days. So let's just watch that space. But you're absolutely right. The whole idea of being able to generate sufficient returns from a savings pool is quite questionable now. Of course, the answer at the moment is, well, you know, people are saying, well, the stock market's doing very well. And of course, we hit the record high in the US over the last few days. But that is completely artificial. That's completely disconnected from the true returns from companies. It's all to do with all that liquidity that we spoke about earlier on, going back into the financial system and just blowing up prices again, right? It's not real. That is not necessarily going to be sustainable long term. And there are many people, experienced investors, saying property is going to, you know, may go sideways, but the stock market is definitely going to fall ahead. It's just when. So the question is, yeah, where are you going to get those big returns? And the answer is, I can't see them. And if that is true, then the pool that you need in dollar terms to generate an income into retirement has got to be 3, 4, 5 times the current pools that people are expecting.
Oh, but it's all right, Martin. Everyone can just get a reverse mortgage on their overpriced house and then everything will be hunky-dory.
Of course. Yes, you know how reverse mortgages work? It's very interesting. The people who make the money, of course, are the financial system again.
I'm shocked.
It's funny that everywhere you look, you know, there's a really interesting phenomenon. Everywhere you look, there is one entity or series of entities that seem to be winning, right? Interest rates go up, the financial system wins. Interest rates come down, they're saved by the government and by the Reserve Bank. You know, mortgage rates go down, that's no problem. You can have cheap funding from from us again. It is remarkable. The financial system and the, you know, the financial engine has become such a dominant factor in the total structure of our society that basically nothing else matters.
No. And that's the that's a big part of what the problems we face today, because it is so large and because it is such a huge source of wealth for so many people and such a huge source of income even for a lot of people, you know, for fund managers and for everybody else who gets their clip of the ticket. It's an enormous part of the economy now. And the problem is now is that you've got the other sort of elements of the parts of the financial system. And because the whole is so enormous and because there are so many issues that could become systemic risks, it's like, oh, no, we can't let the commercial mortgage-backed securities bonds sector die, because that could create systemic risk to the engine of the economy and the engine of all this growth and this thing that supports asset prices. But I think that at the end of the day, a lot of what we're seeing is based on what I would consider to be collective psychology, because, you know, we've seen in Japan what happens when you throw QE at the stock market over a long period of time? Nothing. Nothing. Over time, it all flows through, and in net terms, very little ends up happening. What happens when? What happened in Europe? Nothing. You know, it got it. You know, in some of these, you know, European stock indices are in worse shape than they were before the GFC. You know, and sorry, not before the GFC, shortly after the GFC, and it's ridiculous. You know, it's QE in that way didn't work. It didn't inflate asset prices over the long term. Yes, it did in terms of housing in certain nations. But aside from that, and that's only because of low rates, but aside from that, it hasn't worked to keep stock prices inflated. But by the same token, we're in a situation where reality doesn't matter anymore. What matters is the perception. And the perception has been there for a long, long time. The QE inflates stock prices, and that's what's worked in America, and it continues to work in America. And frankly, you know, I mean, I suppose it's just become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and not, frankly, I don't know when that's going to end.
Well, you're right, because it does ultimately have nothing to do with real mathematics or, you know, real net present value of future flows or vice versa, right? It is psychology, and it's the herd mentality. And interestingly, of course, if you look at what's happened both with crypto and with the stock markets, a lot of new money has come in very recently from people who've never invested before, right? And where did that money come from? Well, they were the handouts. They were the, you know, the superannuation withdrawals and the other programs around the world where people were actually given some money to sort of see them through the coronavirus outbreak and those sorts of things. So we've got a lot of people who are just piling into the markets thinking, oh, this is easy. I never knew it was so easy to make money. Just, you know, I buy today and then it's higher tomorrow until it's not. It is amazing. And it's interesting. I'm talking to a few more experienced market operators who are all sitting on the sidelines saying, you know, this is ridiculous. This is now in fairyland. You know, this is Alice in Wonderland type stuff that's going on at the moment. It's not connected to reality at all. And then they go on to say, well, but you're not sure how long it's going to go on like this.
No. I mean, you've got JP Morgan. I think it was JP Morgan this morning. They came out and said, we're going to get the S&P 500 is going to rise to 4,500
yep.
by the end of next year, which is an increase of about 25% on where it is now. So we're going to see, you know, I mean, Just think about that for a moment. Not only have we seen stocks bounce back, you know, more than 50% from their lows. We're talking about another 25% on top of that. Is the earnings growth there? No. You know, is it going to be there to that degree? No way are earnings going to grow 25% above the level that they need to be to justify that sort of growth. No way. But by the same token, that doesn't matter anymore because rates are low. Chairman Jerome Powell's got my back. I mean, to be honest, there was a point where Jerome Powell came out and said, all investors should be made whole. And on that day, I should have bought stocks. I should have thought, I shouldn't have used my brain. I should have just thought, yes, all investors should be made whole. You're going to do that. You're going to do whatever you need to do to make sure that happens. And I should have bought 12-month call options for where the market was before. And I'd be retired on a nice beach somewhere by now.
Yeah, well, you know, that was a very important statement that he made, and he's been following up on it since as well in terms of, you know, trying to justify, I guess, the strategies. But the question is, you know, can it really go on? And it's interesting because, you know, there are people quoting Davos, you know, 2021 and the Great Reset, you know, and saying, well, we've got to the point now where this whole system has got to the point where it's just not going to function, and therefore we need a new system. And of course, that leads to a whole bunch of a rather silly speculation on what a Great Reset might look like and who's going to win and who's going to lose. Interestingly, of course, Davos was meant to be in January, and now our Davos is later in the year because of COVID. And I always get Davos and Davros muddled up. I don't know whether you know of Davros, but Davros, of course, was the alien Dalek, right? And I think there's something to be said about that. Yeah.
To be honest, it's really quite difficult to predict exactly where all this is going to go because, you know, there is so much debt, there are so many problems. I mean, you know, the idea that almost 14 million Americans are going to lose their unemployment benefits in less than a month's time and basically end up with nothing is just insane to me. I mean, the idea that people are sitting around their dining tables, they're eating Thanksgiving dinner, you know, basically as we speak, thinking about how they're gonna you know make rent in January, how they're gonna pay their mortgage, how they're gonna put food on the table for their children, and they don't know, and they're allowed and even that they're allowed to suffer that, but that psychological torture is bad enough, but the fact that they're actually potentially going to end up with nothing is just it's profoundly wrong when you've got billionaires getting richer by the hundreds and hundreds of billions every month. And you've got Jerome Powell propping up stock prices. And as long as stocks and the financial system stays, you know, relatively solid, all of the, you know, the American political system is more than happy to go home for the holidays. And it's just, it's painfully wrong, to be completely honest with you. But by the same token, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if they tried that in France, the entire country would be on fire.
Well, you know, the French tend to have a rather different attitude to some of these things, although they've got their own economic challenges, of course, as part of the Eurozone. I actually still have the theory that the Eurozone is probably where it's going to go wrong first because of everything that's going on there, but I could be wrong on that. But it is worth, you know, reflecting on how far we've come and how little we've actually achieved, right? So we've got all this debt. We've got all of the low interest rates. We've got all of that. But we haven't solved any of the fundamental structural issues that you and I keep talking about week in, week out, month in, month out, right? And the trouble is there is no appetite amongst leaders to actually try and solve those bigger and more structural issues, right? I mean, everybody is just sort of worrying about the next little tactical thing, it seems to me. And that's, you know, going to go on for quite some time probably, which is a concern because meanwhile, there is a whole other agenda that we should be talking about, which we're not.
No. I mean, you know, someone on Twitter said something to me the other day about it, and they really nailed it. They said, not a single new bridge has been built, not a single rail line, not a single hospital, nothing has been built as a result of all this. You know, we've spent Great Depression stimulus, you know, levels of money, and we have absolutely nothing to show for it. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. We've got a lot of corporate profits and executive bonuses, yes, and shareholder dividends to show for it.
Yes.
And it's just ridiculous that we're in this position, to be completely honest with you, and that no one, literally almost, I mean, I'm sure that there are some countries, I'm pretty sure I saw something positive out of Bhutan the other day, but, you know, relatively speaking, in most nations throughout the world, they're not doing anything with all this money. I mean, everyone gives the Chinese crap for building, you know, building infrastructure that's not really all that productive, but at least they've got something to show for
that's
it.
That's right.
You know? And I mean, I don't know, like I look in Asia, in parts of Asia and, you know, places like Vietnam, places like Thailand, they're spending money on, they're building, you know, great swaths of public housing. They're building high-speed rail lines. They're building port infrastructure. They're building renewable energy. They're doing all these different things. But if you look around the world to all the big Western nations, what are we doing with it? We're just sitting there twiddling our thumbs, pissing money away, hoping that somehow everything gets better.
Yeah. And I think hope is not a plan, as somebody once said. But, you know, it is really worrying that some of those broader issues that should be being thought about are not. I'd also make one other point. I was trying to find out what the latest JobKeeper statistics is, right? And there's been no update for months.
I know. Well, actually, that's not that. There's actually one. There was an update recently. I think it was around about, what was it? I think it was 1,500 businesses a day, I believe. It might have been 12 or 1,500. But that was only up to October 30th.
Correct.
But the problem is that we lack the data on how many people have actually come off JobKeeper. Yeah. And I've been banging on about this for months because Josh Frydenberg said there's 900,000 businesses and there's 3.5 million recipients. And that's not the case anymore. There's 1,057,000 businesses and there are about 4.07 million recipients. So which is, you know, almost 600,000 more than what Josh Frydenberg says.
Yep.
Yet, do we have the update? No. No. And the date that businesses had to get all their stuff in by the last possible moment was October 31st.
Mm.
So here we are, almost a month later, and we have no idea. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because, of course, I ask some JobKeeper and JobSeeker questions in my surveys. And I'm still seeing a net increase in JobKeeper.
Really?
Because the mix have changed, right? So some big businesses have dialed back, but a lot of small businesses who were actually not doing it are now actually involved in doing it. So I'm not sure what the total number is. And, you know, surveys are not statistically robust enough to be able to draw massive conclusions, but there's a question mark in my mind about precisely what's going on.
Well, just think about it and imagine for a second if, you know, when the government made their projections, they said that there's only going to be 1.5 million people on JobKeeper as of January. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, well, I'm very suspicious of that, right? Which is an interesting observation. Now, who knows? Maybe the date is delayed, and we'll get an update. But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's such a fundamental question, right? Such a fundamental platform in terms of what they were trying to do in terms of supporting. That I'm surprised they haven't been more willing to disclose the trajectory of it, unless the news is not good.
Well, the thing is, Josh Frydenberg has been saying that there's been 3.5 million recipients since July, since before Victoria went into lockdown, and that's what Scott Morrison, that's what Anne Rustin, that's what all of them keep saying, 3.5 million recipients, 3.5 million recipients, 900,000 businesses, and they've repeated that infinitum over more than 4 months now, despite knowing full well that's not correct.
Yeah. Well, maybe they'll go on saying it until the real official data comes back to that point again. And then they can say, we won't talk about the hump in the middle.
Oh, sorry. So it's like that land. It's like that land that they bought. You know, we'll just keep saying, no, this is the value. This is the value until finally, you know, 20 years later, it is actually the value.
Yeah. No, it is a bit crazy. But, you know, again, it goes back to we don't really know where the chart and compass is pointing at the moment. There's too much uncertainty. And look, the last thing for me, this 1.8 trillion, right? If you divided that by every single household in Australia, right? It's a big number just for each household and each family, right? And the question is, are we getting value for money from the 1.8 trillion?
No. Well, we're not, are we? I mean, even the RBA's analysis that said that we say that for the $70 billion that we spent on JobKeeper 1.0, we save 700,000 jobs.
Mm.
That's $100,000 a job.
Yep.
Now, I got to ask myself, would that $100,000 would have been better spent on getting these people into an education, or giving them that cash to start a business? Or giving them that cash to do something else, that, you know, some other form of productive endeavor that they might come up with. I mean, I think that we have to ask these questions because, you know, we're talking about enormous sums of money that we're going to be owing for a long time and paying a hell of a lot of interest on. And if rates ever rise, God help us.
Yep. Well, that's really the point, isn't it? Decisions are taken for political reasons. Decisions are taken for opportunistic reasons. But sometimes the decisions that are taken are the wrong decisions. And I think we're facing right into a bunch of those at the moment.
Pretty much. I just struggle with it all, to be completely honest with you. Like, I look at it and I just go, I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not a super genius. You know, it's really quite obvious what you need to do. I mean, you know, we've got in 2013, we had an infrastructure deficit according to infrastructure, I believe it was Infrastructure Australia, of $700 billion. We needed $700 billion of infrastructure to support the population in 2013 in an adequate fashion. Since then, the population's grown by more than 2 million. I think it's about 2.3 million. And now we probably need double that in order to support the existing population. And is the and Morrison's going, oh, well, we're going to do it like $160 billion in infrastructure or whatever it is over 10 years. And it's like, wow, one-tenth of what we need. And in 10 years' time, the population is going to be even bigger.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth, because the last thing, just to underscore, is, of course, there's now a big speculation that they're going to turn the population lever to 11 again and try and get a lot of migration to come in to try and inflate the number of people in the country to be able to force growth, right? Another rather flawed strategy in my view.
Well, I mean, it's really just, you know, pick one, pick a strategy. It's flawed. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, like I really do try to be impartial, and relatively speaking, I'm sort of on the left on some things, I'm on the right on others. So relatively speaking, I'm broadly in the middle, you know, and I mean, to be honest, I grew up with members of my family handing out how to vote cards for the Liberal Party when I was growing up, you know, and I look at them now and I just think, you where are the values? Where are the, you know, I remember them, you know, hearing all the rhetoric, we are the party of small business. Really?
Like, our small business.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to control myself for a second before I start swearing. But to be completely frank, you know, I mean, how can you say you're the party of small business when only 5% of your small business loans were ever taken up by a small by business? I spoke to a representative of one of the big banks about 2 weeks after that sub. I'm not going to say which one because I don't want to get them into any trouble. But and they said to me, I asked them, "Are you guys going to lend based on this?" And they went, "No." No, it's too risky. Too risky. If the government's willing to take a greater percentage of the risk with us, then fine. We'll definitely reconsider it. But if not, no way. It's not going to happen. And they would have said the exact same thing to Scott Morrison. They can't, and Frydenberg. They can't say, "Oh no, we didn't know. We're just incompetent. We didn't know." They knew. They just didn't do enough to actually change that. And it's frankly disappointing. I mean, I don't like using Albo's slogans because frankly I think that, you know, he could be doing a better job, but he's right when he says that it's all photo op and no follow up.
Well, I was going to say there is doing stuff and then there is the appearance of doing stuff, right? And they're very good at the appearance of doing stuff. And as you say, the photo op and the announcement and then the re-announcement of the announcement that was made before. And then they dust it off and then re-announce it again, you know. And the media swallows it and just presents it, right? And everyone says, oh, well, they're doing some good things. And then you hang on a moment, I've heard that one before. You know, you can go back and sort of count them all up. There's a difference between doing stuff and talking about doing stuff. And we're very good at talking.
Well, that's just emblematic of the government. That's what they are. And the problem is that they're so good at it. You know, like people say to me, Scott Morrison's an idiot, and I'm just like, no. He's not an idiot. He has managed to thoroughly pull the wool over the eyes of people to make all these announcements and then never provide basically any money. You know, there are people, you know, still living in mobile homes in areas hit by bushfires almost a year later who've never seen a cent of that money that was intended for them, that was promised for them.
Yep.
You know, there are people in the arts who've never seen a cent of the money that was promised for them, you know, and I just find it a bit ridiculous. I mean, I don't know how all these people who are part of the Liberal Party don't find it morally reprehensible, you know.
You've just used moral? What's that?
No, well, to be honest, like I know some members who are rank and file members of the Liberal Party who are very, very genuine, very nice people. You know, they care about morality. They care about these things. Mm. And I don't know how they are not absolutely livid with the Prime Minister and the government over what they've done, what they haven't done, what they've promised to do and then not done. You know, I don't think that type of behaviour and that type of governance would have lasted 5 minutes under the likes, under the sort of Keating, Hawke and Howard era. If you had have done that sort of stuff, you would have been run out of Parliament.
Yeah. But it's interesting, Tariq, because it's not just here in Australia, right? It's around the world. It's where the political debate has gone to where effectively it is all about debate and spin rather than action and outcomes. And that seems to me to be probably the biggest, you know, question mark that I've got in terms of tackling any of these fundamental issues that we've been touching on today, right? Because if you really are just spinning and, you know, basically just looking to the next election and that's all, and not really thinking about the things that really need to be done to improve society and to improve the well-being of citizens around the world, then we've come a long way down the road, but it's not a road that I want to travel.
No. And I just if I got a little bit ranty there, audience, I do apologize. That does happen at times. But yeah, you're right. It isn't just Australia. It's the world, and it's profoundly sad to watch all this money be frittered away, you know, and spent on, you know, basically something that we're not going to really have all that much to show for. And it makes me wonder sometimes that, because the thing is, say here in Australia, we're quite lucky. We've got low debt. So basically they can keep playing extended pretend for the next 10 years. And, you know, eventually we'll end up roughly where sort of Italy or Greece was, you know, before the financial crisis, which is really, in relative terms, by today's standards, not all that bad. You know, but for the rest of the world, I really do wonder just how it's going to play out. You know, they can't keep throwing money at all this forever.
Yep.
And eventually for people who are suffering, you know, like the, you know, the 54 million Americans who are going hungry at the moment, eventually they're going to turn around and they're going to say, well, this is bull. This is crap. You know, it's just ridiculous. And I don't think people are going to stand for it forever.
No, but don't worry, because in Australia, home prices will still be high. So everything's going to be fine. Everything in the garden is wonderful. So don't panic.
It's scary that that's really all that matters. I mean, Lindsay David did a great tweet the other day pointing out how many times Philip Lowe mentioned housing prices in one of his speeches. And it's just absurd. You know, I think it was like 33 times. I mean, no, it sure would be nice if we had an actual economy that wasn't just housing prices and mining, especially now that, you know, China's sort of kneecapping us on the mining side of things with the coal and everything else.
But we'll always have houses, so, you know, that's just the way it is.
Oh, I really do wish. You know what I think the worst part of all of this? All the people who leveraged up, who did the most idiotically stupid things that were idiotically stupid things before 2020, that got themselves into all this debt and all this, you know, did all these silly things, are going to win.
Yeah.
You know, if the government's plans for all of this stimulus and all this super and everything else, and, you know, if it really is, we are going to absolutely destroy everything we need to, you know, the currency, the budget, you know, people's retirements, whatever it is, to get housing prices to rise. If that is the case, all of those people are going to win. And if you're one of these people, like myself, who's been diligently saving, who's been frugal, who's done, you know, what you taught from a very young age is the right thing, you're getting screwed. And I just find that just so incredibly wrong. But by the same token, that's just the world today, you know? If you're the person who went out and bought, you know, a stupid company on a stupid valuation on no revenue, you know, I take that back. If you went out there and bought a company that was bankrupt, that you're never going to see a cent from, and then you saw, you know, 10x returns, you know, that is emblematic of today's society. And that's my rant for today.
Well, yeah, you and I see it the same way. And, you know, I'm afraid that I still believe that there is actually some rules about personal finances, and that, you know, debts can be a risk and people should take care. But I have to say that there are people out there who have gone a different route, and basically their backs are being looked after by the powers that be. So interesting times, huh?
Well, that I'm pretty sure that's what we said at the end of our first interview. It's like we cursed the entire planet.
Correct. Exactly. We did it. Tariq, I appreciate your time today. Always worth exploring the issues with you, and we'll do it again soon, eh?
Yeah, definitely, mate. Looking forward to it.
Take care. Bye.